Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship books and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Nicole Gregory, the author of Desert Missionary, a novel based on the life of Father Eusebio Kino. This Jesuit missionary, born in 1645 in what is now northern Italy, became a geographer, a cartographer, and an astronomer. In the last quarter of his life, he explored Mexico and the southwestern U.S., where he proved that Baja California is a peninsula and not an island. Welcome today, Nicole.
Hi.
We love to start out with the fact that why do you think Father Kino's life is important to us today? What do we learn from him today?
Well, he was a courageous missionary. And back then, in the late 1600s, Jesuit missionaries really wanted to go to China. And he wanted to go to China. That was the go-to place for missionaries. But he was assigned to go to what was called New Spain, which was a big disappointment in his eyes at the time. But when I was reading the background of how he got there and what it was like once he was there, I realized that he was incredibly courageous and brave, just across the ocean, first of all, in these wooden ships that were subject to all kinds of storms and disease. And then once he was there, he was a pioneer. He went into literally uncharted territory and met with Native Americans who'd never seen a white man before. So his courage, I think, is really remarkable in a way that we in this era can not really understand.
It sounds as if it's equatable to if we had landed on the moon and found people there.
Exactly. But he had a complication, which was he felt that he answered to God, and yet he was embedded with the Spanish military, and they wanted him to obey him and follow their direction. And they were very much at war with the Native American tribes that they came in contact with, and they were quite ruthless, and the Native American tribes were quite ruthless in return. And yet Eusebio Kino saw himself as a missionary for God, and he tried to defend the Native American people that he came in contact with from the Spanish, and it put him in a very difficult and very dangerous position.
That's so sad to think you're trying to mitigate or be a diplomat between something that was almost too hard to stop.
Absolutely. And yet he knew missionaries who were killed by Native Americans, and he sometimes intervened in conflicts and tried to ward off conflicts. I mean, he felt he was doing the will of God to promote peace, but it was almost impossible. But I want to say another thing, which was he was a scientist. And he, before he actually got to Mexico or New Spain, he witnessed a comet in Seville, or near Seville. And it was a comet that lasted a number of weeks, and he recorded it. I mean, he recorded what he witnessed, and it was very dramatic, very bright in the night, apparently, across the sky. And he later wrote about it as evidence of God. But at the time, comets were seen as bad luck. So he promoted the idea of natural phenomena being signs of God rather than signs, you know, more sort of voodoo of bad luck or impending disaster.
That's so interesting because it's true when we think about it, it's how we interpret those things. And I always have been told by different very Catholic friends that, you know, science is just proof that God made up stuff we haven't figured out yet.
Ah, very good. Yes. Well, that, I think that was his approach, too. I mean, he loved science and he loved being a scientist, recording everything that he witnessed. And he was very well educated. He went to university in Germany. And so I think he didn't see a conflict between science and God as some people do today.
Ah, that's lovely. Well, then we can learn a lot from him.
Absolutely.
That's beautiful. So speaking of university, even before he got to university, how was he prepared for that? What were you able to find out about his childhood?
They were farmers. And yet he had a cousin who was a Jesuit missionary who entered his life a couple times when he was a child who had made maps. And I think from what I read that Eusebio was intrigued by these maps of other lands, particularly China and other people that he couldn't even imagine. And so he became struck by these maps and the idea of traveling. And then because missionaries, I think, were held in such high regard in the society, he really wanted to do that himself. And then he felt like he was delivering the word of God to people who'd never heard of God, and he felt that was his calling. But I think education was a key part of his upbringing. His parents really believed in education. And so he, when you think about it, education was a very special thing back in the 1600s. Not everybody got it. And so it was kind of incredible that his parents allowed him to be educated rather than insisting that he stay and work on their farm for the rest of his life.
Was that part of, they had more than one child, obviously? They had others to work on the farm, or do we know?
As far as I know, he was the only one, and that his parents just highly regarded education.
That's beautiful. So nowadays we would say, oh, he was spoiled, but what a lovely way to be spoiled.
Absolutely. And yet he had this other wonderful part of his childhood, which is he had free reign of the land around his family's farm, and he was in the Alps, as I recall. So he was in incredible landscape, and he explored it as a boy. He was free to ride horses bareback and try to cross streams and rivers. You know, it was a different kind of childhood than most people know today. But it gave him a kind of physical freedom and a physical strength, so that when he was actually exploring parts of what we know as Mexico or the southwest of the United States, he was in extreme circumstances, extreme weather, long stretches of desert without water. He was used to that in a way.
That makes sense. And that prepared him for that future. He had no idea what it would be.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. So, and you spoke of his cousin and his parents. So are these, and what are the other relationships that sort of fueled him as he went through life?
Well, one of the most intriguing ones that I discovered was that when he was waiting for the ship to take him to New Spain, he met a duchess. She was a fine lady, and they met over a sick child that they both cared for, and she was a very educated woman and had a very strong spiritual side. He was very educated, obviously had a spiritual side, and they created a friendship. And she funded part of the ship that took him over to New Spain, and then once he was there, he corresponded with her and he wrote to her. So because this was assigned as a novel, I elaborated on that relationship so that they continued their correspondence probably longer than it did actually continue. And even when it did end, I created dreams where she entered his consciousness and gave him some direction.
I love that, because we don't know for sure. I mean, the idea of correspondence in the first place is something we've sort of forgotten. And yet people would have these friendships that went across continents and across the ocean because of the ability to write. And that's how we have the archives to understand their lives.
Yes, and don't forget, they would get letters sometimes 2 years after they were written. So it wasn't immediate like what we have today. It took a long time to go back and forth.
To find out how the other person was and what was the story of their life, and to get answers to the questions that you sent.
Yes,
that's amazing.
Exactly.
Amazing. And yet, it's in writing as opposed to email, which disappears into the ether.
Yes, and there, you know, a lot of the research that we have is due to letters. Also, when he was on these ships, they would make lists of things that they needed, things that they were carrying, their supplies, who, you know, what happened, people who died on the ships. I think the basis of most of the history that we have of this time is through those kinds of written materials.
I love that. That's what's so great about archives.
Mm-hmm, truly.
I'm going to guess that many listeners have never heard of him. Had you at all heard of him, and what was the impression when you just got your first sort of touch of what his life was like?
I had never heard of him, but as soon as I started doing research, I realized that Jesuits definitely know who he is. And Jesuits in the area of Arizona really know who he is. In fact, there are a lot of places named after him. And one of the things he did was when he encountered a lot of these native tribes, there was an exchange of talents, obviously, but he helped teach how to grow certain European plants. And he brought some agricultural practices that he had known in Europe to these Native American tribes. And that's why some of them flourished, especially in the Arizona area. So there are monuments to him there. There are areas that are named after him there. But I had never heard of him. But I think that there are large groups of people that do know of him and admire him.
Well, and now they can read more and learn more about him.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. A beautiful idea. All right, so in researching, what do you think was the most interesting thing you found about him that you were so excited to go, oh, that's so cool?
Well, you know, the discovery that Baja was not an island, seems like not much of a deal to us, but it was an accepted fact that Baja was an island, and he, through his exploration, and don't forget, he was on horseback, maybe with food and water and maybe not, and he had to use his knowledge of the constellations to get him from one place to another. Anyway, his exploration was incredibly rugged and rough, and yet he used that to understand the territory that he was traveling in. And I think it was actually he got a hint by seeing a seashell that one Native American had, and he knew that it came from a certain part of Baja or a certain beach in Baja. And that kind of gave him this clue to keep trying to find out, to establish that Baja was part of the mainland, so to speak.
That's so interesting for people, of course, who traveled to Baja, California, to think, well, it's normal, we understand that, but somebody had to discover it.
That's right.
And rarely do we get down to the who did that, who had the curiosity, and as you said earlier, the courage to see what was as far as you could go.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I love that.
But I want to also say that I think he was incredibly lonely. I think he didn't come across many people who had his level of intellect and his compassion for the Native American people that he was encountering. The other thing that I have to say that I discovered is how many tribes there were. Hundreds of different tribes, each with different cultures and characteristics. And it put me in awe once again of all that we don't know about the people who lived here before white people came.
And that speaks back to the idea that we have a bias toward written history as opposed to oral history, which is what the Native mm-hmm. Americans had. And so we dismissed that in the early days of historian taking. You're right, exactly. It's like, oh, that doesn't matter because it's not written down anywhere, but it does.
Truly.
And I think it's also important to recognize there were people in the day who recognized we should be diplomatically relating as opposed to being conquerors, but their opinions were in the minority.
Yes, and you know, also I've learned from my research is that a lot of the people that came with the military were people who were criminals, basically, who had a choice of either being in prison or accompanying explorers or military. So some of them were really just not very good people, and they took advantage of anyone they could. To me, it's incredible that he even lived as long as he lived, because the circumstances were so extreme sometimes.
True. Amazing that he didn't get a disease. Amazing that he wasn't killed in some fashion. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He had a mission.
He had a mission. And there were missionaries who were killed awfully, friends of his. I guess because some Native Americans saw all white men as trouble and aggressors.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. If only they could all have sat down and had a conversation.
Yeah.
We keep trying to learn that.
Yeah. To this day.
To this day, exactly, exactly. Well, you hit on the fact, of course, that these are novels. These are historical fictions based in the lives of these people. So I always love to ask writers, what was your favorite scene to have created, knowing that we are making up some things, some conversations, some parts of the story? What did you delight in creating for his life?
I'd really liked creating the dreams in which the Duchess came to him and spoke to him because, like I said, I felt that he was a lonely person and he had to do a lot without anyone encouraging him or directing him. I mean, he did get messages from Italy, but very...
2 years late.
Two years later. And so he didn't have much support for what he was doing, but he believed in it. And so I used those dreams as a way for him to kind of, as a character, express his wishes for him, for his life, and also his need for some kind of companionship that he did get with her when he was friends with her in Spain. So I enjoyed that a lot. But I also created some conversations that he had with some of the tribes people. And that was satisfying, but I also tried to not sugar it up so that it sounded like everything was just all sweet between him and everybody else. I'm sure that it wasn't.
Exactly. Sadly.
Sadly.
Sadly. That's so true. So I always like to think, too, from an author's standpoint, you get offered this chance to write about a particular person. How do you then find something in your own background that connects you to the story, that makes you feel like you can understand this person?
Well, I'd say because I have a spiritual side, I tried to connect to him in that way. My admiration for him is huge because he acted on his spirituality. He had a mission that was directly connected to his concept of God. And I understood him that way. You know, I felt like I have a spiritual side. It doesn't direct me to do that sort of thing, but I understand that part of him. And I felt like in him, as opposed to some other missionaries at the time, his mission was pure. He really did want to bring the word of God to people. He didn't have a double purpose. He wasn't looking for money. He wasn't looking for fame. And he, you know, fraternized with some very wealthy Spanish people who had settled in Mexico, who wanted to kind of bring him into their high society, as it was at the time. And he kind of delicately allowed himself to have that luxury, but he didn't hold on to it. He kept on exploring. So I felt like he was a really great character. He had some depth, he had education, and he had spirituality that directed him to an incredible life.
I think that's so beautiful because these are the lives we like to focus on, right? And the whole concept of the Mentoris Project is this idea of mentorship. So, of course, the first thing I'd like to ask is, who do you think mentored him, and were there people that he then mentored?
Well, yes, there were a number of younger priests that came along with him, alongside of him during different parts of his exploration. And also, he was in Mexico, what was called New Spain, and he was very restless there because he knew he wanted to get like further out, further away from civilization, so to speak, such as it was at the time. So he mentored a lot of people who were younger priests that traveled with him for different parts of the journey. He had some close friendships, fellow explorers. He made friends among the Spanish military who, you know, they had mutual respect. But in terms of real mentorship, I think he was on his own. I think maybe when he was a child, there were certain, or a young student, there were scholars and scientists who he really respected and revered. But once he was starting on his exploration, he was on his own.
Wow. You have to be so motivated to move forward like that.
Truly, and strong. Strong of character, strong of body.
True, both. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, then, I generally then like to end with the question of who would you say are your mentors in life?
Ah, well, I didn't have a mentor, so to speak, in my writing career, but my godfather was a writer, and I was thinking about this question because I had a feeling you would ask. He had a knack for interviewing people. He was a nonfiction science writer, and I had seen him talk to people, and he had a very engaging way of asking questions and sort of diving into people's lives. And he had such a joy about it that I remember feeling like, that looks like a fun thing to do. And he made connections with people he interviewed in a really nice way, very friendly, but he really elicited a lot of good personal information from people he was interviewing. So I think that really affected me.
That's so pretty. It's as if he mentored through role modeling.
Yes, exactly. I'd say that's exactly what it was.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I'm excited about the book, and I can't wait for other people to read it.
Yes, me too. Thanks, Roseanne.
Take care. Thanks for listening to the Mentoris Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.